Not pollute them. Yes?
That they flow in their own way.
Flow in their own way, and blood when they want to. So I don't know what the agency is here in Belgium, but in America we have what's called the Army Corps of Engineers. And what they do is they go to the rivers and they restrict their courses. They put concrete and all kinds of things there so that they force the rivers to stay in a particular course. Normally rivers change their course over time. Now, of course, if the river changes its course over time, then the people living by the side of the rivers become inconvenienced because, you know, you have a home and then you don't have a home. The river's over here, and then the river's over here, and then the river's over here, and then the river's over here. And as far as flooding, the governments of the world take great pains to make sure that the rivers never flood. Of course, it doesn't always work. Sometimes the levees break and the rivers flood anyway. But then because a society is not set up for flooding, it's an absolute catastrophe. And so many things are ruined in parts of the world where they still, there's not very many of those places left, allow the rivers to flood. How do they do? How do they build their homes? Yeah, on stilts, exactly. And they've made allowance for that. What benefit happens? Of course, not polluting the rivers is obvious. If you don't pollute the rivers, then you can drink the water. When's the last time anyone here drank water out of a clean, clear, unpolluted river? The last time, when did you do that?
My brother.
Oh, in Florida. Okay, the last time I think I did that was when I was 16 at Banff Jamf National Park in the western part of Canada. And it was so nice. We'd go up in the Rocky Mountains and the rivers were so clean. And we'd say, can we drink the water? And so then you can use that water for everything. And I have one member of our movement who was able to live off of prana, and he was telling me how you can get prana from flowing water. So we were at a big festival, and I said, can you get prana from this water? And he said, no, it's all polluted. That just meant they're going to detract your energy. So actually, clear water is giving people energy. And what about if the river's allowed to change course? How does that benefit anyone? How does that happen? How does the river changing course and being allowed to flood, how does that add to fertility?
It's silt from the ground leaves in mineral deposits and other deposits that enrich the soil, which eventually enrich the crops.
Yeah, if you see the course of a river, when the river starts out, and you can tell that I was a teacher for a long time, we show lots of science films on rivers. And when they start out, they're flowing very, very fast, and they're very clear. And as they gradually go down to the ocean, or sometimes to a lake, they slow down. And as they, what's happening when they're going very, very fast is they're picking up the soil from the banks, especially from the mountains where things are very clean. And as they get heavy with the soil that they're carrying, they start to slow down. Also, as they get closer to the sea, generally the drop is less steep, and so they also slow down. And as they slow down, they start to meander, which is why the rivers change their course. They're not fast enough to plow a straight path. So they start moving around, and as they move around heavy with the soil, they start dropping some of the soil. So they're dropping some of the soil, and they move someplace, and that way they fertilize the whole land. And when they flood, they're taking all this rich soil from the mountains and depositing it over a very wide area. And if this is done, you don't need to use artificial fertilizers. You have a natural system of fertilization. So if rivers are not polluted and are allowed to flow their own way, or sometimes allowed to flood the land will become very fertile and able to produce all kinds of vegetables, trees, and plants. The word rasa means taste. Actually, all rasas are taste within the earth. Now, we will really think about this. Now, Prabhupada is saying rasas are taste within the earth. And I want us to really meditate. Why is he saying within the earth? What does it say in the verse? It says rasas are coming from the Nadya. River. It says rasas are coming from the river. And Krishna says, rasaha apsukanteya. He says, I am tasting water. So rasa, in fact, literally means liquid. So the taste is coming from water, but here Srila Prabhupada says the taste is coming from earth. I just think about this a little bit. Actually, all rasas are taste within the earth, And as soon as seeds are sown in the ground, various trees sprout up to satisfy our different tastes. For example, sugar cane provides its juices to satisfy our taste for sweetness, and oranges provide their juices to satisfy our taste. Notice he mentions juices. Sugar cane provides its juices to satisfy our taste for sweetness, and oranges provide their juices to satisfy our taste for a mixture of the sour and the sweet. Similarly, there are pineapples and other fruits. Pineapples are astringent. Does anyone know the sixth taste? Anybody in the Ayurvedic people know the sixth taste? Sweet, salty, sour, bitter, pungent, and astringent. At the same time, there are chilies to satisfy our taste for pungency. Although the earth's ground is the same, different tastes arise due to different kinds of seeds. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Bijaham Sabhinitam, I am the original seed of all existences. So you know Krishna says he's the taste in water. He says he's the seed of all existence. And what does he say he is in the earth? Then? Okay. Therefore, all arrangements are there. All arrangements are there. Arrangements for what? Different kinds of? Taste. Different kinds of essence. And as stated in Isha Kamsha, Purnamidam, complete arrangements for the production of all necessities of life are made by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Why are these necessities of life? Are chilies necessary for life? Food? But we're not talking just about food. We're talking about what? Taste. Are pineapples necessary for life? Probably an example. Chilies, pineapples, are those necessities of life? Are those necessities of life? Are they? No. Complete arrangements for the production of all the necessities of life are made by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. People should therefore learn how to satisfy the Yajna Purusha or Vishnu. Indeed, the living entity's prime business is to satisfy the Lord, because the living entity is part and parcel of the Lord. So why is it our business to satisfy the Lord? Because we are? What did Prabhupada say? Part and parcel. Thus, the whole system is so arranged that the living entity must do his duty as he is constitutionally made. Without doing so, all living entities must suffer. That is the law of nature. So if we want to be happy, we do what? What do we do if we want to be happy? Serve Krishna, and particularly it says, our prime business is to? Our prime business is to suffer. Okay. Yes. Hare Krishna. Okay. Our prime business is to satisfy the Lord. To satisfy the Lord. Otherwise we will suffer. The words Targo, Buri, Varshmana indicate very luxuriously grown big-bodied trees. The purpose of these trees was to produce honey and varieties of fruit. In other words, the forest also has its purpose in supplying honey, fruits, and flowers. Is honey a necessity?
No.
What about flowers? Flowers are necessity. In other words, the forest also has its purpose in supplying honey, fruits, and flowers. Unfortunately, in Kali Yuga, due to the absence of yajna, there are many big trees in the forest, but they do not supply sufficient fruits and honey. Thus, everything is dependent on the performance of yajna. The best way to perform yajna in this age is to spread the Sankirtan movement all over. Uhu sarva sannadhyā kṣīra dhādhyāna gaura san padagaura mūdhi varṣmaḥ prasthu-yantam aru-chitā. The flowing rivers supply all kinds of taste, sweet, pungent, sour, etc. And very big trees supply fruit and honey in abundance. The cows, having eaten sufficient green grass, supply profuse quantities of milk, curd, clarified butter, and similar other necessities. So, yeah, when I go to Hawaii, I see this. You could live in the forest in Hawaii, no problem. It would be difficult to be an authentic, you know, non-crust or sannyasi in Hawaii because there are clear streams you can drink out of, and there's avocado trees and banana trees and orange trees and macadamia nut trees and all over the place. You know, you can even get flowers for your puja. It would just be absolutely no problem. The last time I was there, we saw some homeless people living under a bridge. And they didn't actually need anything. They had the water, there was water under the bridge, they could bathe in it, there was fruit and flower and trees. And soon after that, I was in Vancouver Island in Canada, and it was just as pretty as Hawaii, which you couldn't live there because all there were pine trees. And just like here, you know, if we said, okay, go live in the forest, it'd be pretty tough. What would you need? Stones. Oh, okay, lots of stones. I mean, maybe there's some edible roots here in the forest, a few things, but it would be pretty tough. And even the food that we grow. So I just had the opportunity recently in Slovenia to stay at the home of these devotees who grow pretty much all their own food. They have a garden outside their house and another big property, and they've been eating raw food for 14 years. You see the man in the house, he just gets this big bowl all full of cucumbers. Whoa. And he told me he doesn't even need to drink water because there's so much water in there. He doesn't drink anything because there's so much natural water in the food. And, you know, you're eating this food that's all organically grown, picked fresh an hour ago out of their garden, and eaten by Krishna. And you just think there's nothing else you want in the universe but that. Completely satisfied. From there, I went to Hungary, where also they were everything. Even the wheat in Hungary was from their own fields and ground by their oxen and their grinding machine. And the milk is from their own cows and offered to Radhasham. You just feel that you're completely, materially, that you're completely satisfied. So this particular purport reminds me of something written by Arthur Conan Doyle, who wrote the Sherlock Mysteries. Some of you might be familiar. So one day, Sherlock Holmes is talking to Watson, and he said, I really think God must be good. And we can understand with our intelligence that there must be a God. That's pretty simple. That's like somebody must have made that cushion. Is that cushion very complex? Is that very complex? It's very simple. But if I said to you, a one-year-old child made that cushion, would you believe it? I said, a cat made it, would you believe it? You think that was crazy. What to speak of if I said it just appeared here, you know, the floor just sort of manifested. Cushions won't there. So what to speak of, you know, for something this simple, you know, we look at the altar. If I said, you know, that altar was made by a chimpanzee, I think Matsya Vittori would be a little offended. But what to speak of if you look at the world? How could that not be made by somebody with intelligence? So anybody with, you know, a modicum of intelligence can figure out there must be a creator, and the creator must be awfully clever and awfully artistic and awfully powerful. But is the creator good or bad? I mean, there's a lot of nasty things in the world too. What kind of a highly intelligent, powerful person is it? So, Sherlock Holmes is saying, I think he must be good. And Watson says, why? He says, because there's flowers. He says, nobody needs flowers. Nobody needs flowers. It's not necessary for life to have flowers.
The bees,
well, that's, but you could have made a world where there were no flowers.
But you must have insects.
Well, that's the way we see it, but the world could have been arranged without that.
Okay.
Right? And also, bees sometimes pollinate flowers that have no color or fragrance for us. Many times. Why are there beautiful, fragrant flowers? He said, only good people provide something beyond the necessities. Evil people only provide what you absolutely need just to function. Just like in the concentration camps in Nazi Germany. They gave people just enough food so they could work for, you know, a few months. Barely. Just barely enough food. And it had no taste. They'd give them food with no taste. Just enough nutrition so that they could exploit them. Or if you read the book Salted Bread, out of the devotees who were at the prisons, the same thing. They got food that had no taste or horrible taste. no flavor, and just enough to maintain them, and nothing more than that. So if someone's giving something beyond, then that is a sign of goodness. And just think, to whom is Krishna giving this? Even now in Kali Yuga, of course, when we're eating food from the supermarket grown with pesticides, it doesn't have much taste. Especially if you've just come from, you know, New Rajan or this place in Slovenia, or if you've ever grown your own food, any of you ever grown your own food? You just don't want to buy anything from the store anymore. It's like torture to put out your hand and grab the zucchini from the shelf after you've eaten the zucchini grown in your garden. There's no comparison with the flavor. But even so, there's still some flavor in there, pesticide, fertilizer, grown, you say tomatoes or tomatoes here? Tomatoes. There's some flavor. Even people who aren't performing any yoga, they're still getting some taste. Even the atheists, they're still getting some taste. Do you think even the demoniac, atheistic people on the planet at the present time still have some taste in their life? There's still some flavor in their life? Can they still buy flowers? So what kind of person is that? I'm sure there's somebody in our life, at least one person in our life, who's envied us, who's hated us, who's wanted to destroy us, not even for any good reason necessarily. Some small insult or some misunderstanding, or who knows, just because we had something they wanted. Would we give that person lasagna, strawberry lassis, and roses? We want to throw them in prison and give them just dry bread. We don't want to give them all happiness. We don't generally feel charitable towards those who hate us. And if somebody wrote, if you opened up your email today and there was an email, I hate you. I'm going to try to ruin you. I'm going to go to everyone in this town and tell lies about you so that you won't be able to live in any temple. I'll tell people you don't exist. I'll tell people you're not really a person. You're just a machine. I'll do everything I can to destroy you. I'll steal your wealth. Would you say, oh, I think I'll arrange to send, you know, a package of candy to this person? That's exactly what Krishna's doing. Even though we're so, we've come here out of envy again, and still he's supplying us beyond necessities. He's supplying us with rasa. Now, we're not able, just like the persons who are buying their zucchini from the supermarket, they cannot get the same rasa as someone who's growing their zucchini in their backyard. Or just like someone gave the flowers now, they have practically no fragrance. When I was on Vancouver Island, I stayed with some devotees who were growing old roses, the original roses before the hybrids, and they were all so fragrant. You just pick a few of the deities and the whole room is scented with roses. So it's a fact that the rasa we're tasting here is nothing compared to the rasa that Indra's tasting, which is nothing compared to the rasa that we're tasting on Tritasing, on Janaloka and Tapaloka or Brahmaloka, what to speak of compared to Vaikuntha, what to speak of compared to Ayodhya or Dwarka or Vrindavan. The rasa experience, Krishna's called Rasaraj, the rasa experience just by looking at one of Krishna's toenails, how can you, you know, talk about eating a tomato? But still Krishna's giving us some rasa. And this rasa is him. It's nothing but him. So you're saying it's in the earth. So think about taste. You can't have taste without water. I think I mentioned that also the other day. All pleasure is dependent on water. Rasa doesn't just mean taste for the tongue. Any kind of taste, any kind of enjoyment requires water. Just like I'm looking at this beautiful temple now with the gold and the marble. In order to see, my eyes have to be moist. If your eyes are completely dry, you wouldn't be able to see. We would be able to smell without some moisture in your nose. If you try, this in primary school, you dry your tongue, then you put some salt on it, you can't taste it. You need the moisture, you need wax in the ears in order to hear. You need some moisture in your skin in order to feel. If your skin's all dry and cracked, it's simply painful. So all of our tastes are coming from liquid. But Prabhupada's here also talking about the earth, because we know that in order to taste food, you also have to smell. Haven't you ever had a bad cold where you couldn't smell anything? And you could still taste the main taste, sweet, salty, bitter, sour, and astringent, but you couldn't taste the variety, isn't it? The more subtle varieties are there in the smell. And a lot of what we call taste in food, like cinnamon or vanilla, is really a smell. It's not actually literally a taste. And Krishna says, he's that smell. So he's that smell, he's that taste, he is the earth. He's not only the fragrance in the earth, he's the very earth that's supporting all of these things. And he is the light of the sun that the plants are also eating. When we're eating things, we're actually also eating the sun. Some yogis directly eat the sun, but we're eating the sun. What is the sun? The sun is Krishna's effulgence. So everything we're tasting in this world, even the demons, everything you're tasting, they're actually tasting Krishna. Even if they're getting happiness from something abominable, if someone's getting happiness from murder, Krishna says, I am devil. Even that lesson is Krishna. I am destruction. If someone's getting happiness from the taste of eating rotting food, Krishna says he's the beginning, middle, and end of all things. Even someone who's relishing the end of things, that every rasa they're getting Krishna. So Krishna's giving a little taste of himself to rebellious envious souls. And even that little taste is so wonderful and so amazing that conditioned souls spend their whole lives running after these things. Now we're hesitant, we were talking the other day, why when we hear the word surrender, right, we go, oh, how can I surrender? But everybody's surrendering. Just think of what trouble people go through to go to school and get their degree just so they can get a job. Right? Just so they can enjoy some taste. Just so they can buy, you know, a new stereo system and get that taste of the sound. Krishna says, I am sound. Is not everybody surrendering? Is not everyone doing tapasya? Krishna says, I am the enjoyer of all your tapasya. Yeah, you do your tapasya, and what you get is actually Krishna. And Krishna didn't have to arrange it like that. People could have just worked hard. This just could be a labor camp where you worked hard and there's no taste. So Krishna's giving taste to everyone, even to the little insects and the worms and the scorpions. They're also getting some rasa. That is how kind the Lord is. So someone who has the slightest bit of intelligence, if somebody's that kind to me, then I should try to make them happy. I should try to satisfy them. If someone to whom I've acted as an enemy is giving me their very self, and allowing me to enjoy their self. Everything we're enjoying in this world is Krishna. And whatever we enjoy, anything we like, we're actually enjoying Krishna. How am I not making him happy? Look what he's doing to try to make me happy. Even though he's no reason to do it. Logically, why do that? Why not put me forever in Mahavishnu? Never, ever, slumber. Why let me live a kobana and become? Why is he fulfilling all desires? That's his kindness. So shouldn't I want to make him happy? Even if I'm just selfish, even if I'm just thinking about myself, I should want to please the person who's giving me everything. Right? Even if I'm completely selfish. What to speak if I'm a little bit civilized? As Krishna tells the gopis, merchants are worse than people who don't have any love. And then it says here, if we don't do this, we suffer. Now that's not that Krishna's mean in saying, if you don't try to please him, you're going to suffer. It's not like that. It's a natural consequence. Just a natural consequence. If I don't, if I'm not pleasing the person who's, of whom I am a part, Prabhupada says here we should satisfy Krishna because we're part of him, then naturally I'm going to feel pain. It's just natural. I was saying the other day, you put the food in your eyes instead of in your stomach, you're going to feel pain. But it's not the food's fault. It's not that, you know, the carrot is evil and if you don't put it in your stomach, it'll give you pain. You're the one who's sticking it in your eyes or poking it in your arm. So if we're trying to satisfy ourselves separate from Krishna, we're going to feel pain. Or I think of it just like, you know, a dance. Like we have a dancer here, but she dances alone. And sometimes you have a dance with several dancers, and it's all coordinated. And if one dancer decides, oh, I'm going to be the big star, well, we're going to start walking into everybody else. It's not the fault of the dancer, the stage, or it's just, that's what happens. So when I'm in the mood of rebellion against Krishna, even though all my pleasure is coming from Krishna, I can't really enjoy it. I'm hating the very source of my own pleasure. How can I enjoy pleasure when I'm angry at the fact that I'm dependent on someone else for that happiness? You ever been in that circumstance? Someone's giving you something, but you don't like being dependent on that person? And so you can't really enjoy what you get. So therefore, conditioned living entity can't really enjoy. The getting always wins, but they can't actually enjoy it. They're full of resentment. Why do I have to be dependent on someone else for my pleasure? Why can't I create my own pleasure? So the mood of the devotee, the beginning mood, is at least thank you. That is the beginning mood. And gradually one comes to the point that one no longer cares about what one gets. First it's, okay, let me be grateful to the person who's with me. Well, let me surrender to that person. Let me try to satisfy them. And after a while, it just becomes, wait a minute. If this person's giving me all this stuff when I'm rebellious, I wonder what would happen if I was actually in harmony with this person. What would they give me? And if this is what's given, just think of the beauty of the world. Isn't sunset beautiful? Sunsets over mountains by oceans. What kind of beauty do you think he'd give us if we were nice people? That's what, guess what God gives to his enemies. There's even a subterranean heavenly planet for the demons that's nicer than Indra's planet. What do you think he gives to devotees? And Kundari Yudhi, maybe you heard that verse about Putana, how Krishna has given himself to Putana. What does he give to the devotees? Immediately he went and said, what the heck is this? And I'm sure we've all had some desire in service that we just wanted something that Krishna gave us. Have we had that? Or something even for ourselves? You know, we were thinking someday, I'd really like a samosa. And an hour later or a minute later, somebody handed us a samosa. We all had experience. And then you think, wow. I actually want the Krishna prema, I think he gave it to me. He's giving me a stupid samosa, you know, or a new pair of shoes or something. And Krishna wants more than anything else, he wants to give us Krishna prema. That's what he wants. That's what he's dying to give us. When are they going to ask me for it? So when we become really intelligent, we forget about anything for ourselves. And we simply think, let me make this guy happy. And as soon as we make Krishna happy, then he's going to give us that. So at least we can start by meditating about how wonderful he is. At least we can start with that. If we're not at the point of saying, yes, I'm going to forget myself and just try to satisfy Krishna's senses, we can at least appreciate how wonderful he is. Whatever, throughout the day, anything that gives us any kind of pleasure, See Krishna.
That's Krishna.
That's Krishna. So we'll see how it's connected with Krishna. And then one naturally will start to identify some. One will naturally start thinking, you know, Krishna's probably more intelligent than I am. And if he wants, for example, the rivers to go where they want to go, I should let that happen. You know, he's got a better arrangement for everything. And let me cooperate with him rather than competing with him. Rather than saying, okay, you don't know what you're doing, Lord. I've got a better way. I'm going to put concrete in the river and put, you know, chemical fertilizers on the land. Let him do it your way. Let me live my life your way. And my opulence and my happiness will increase and increase and increase and increase and increase. To the point that I'm completely doing things your way, which is a world of love. Where there's no question that what am I getting out of it? And then I get everything. I was just hearing the Vriya Bhagavatamrita, how the residents of Vaikuntha are so opulent, go look more how they are all about. And that's just right. So if Krishna is giving us himself now, what will he not give of himself when we are on that platform? So thank you very much. We had such a nice kirtan and went on a little late, so things were late, but that's all right. In the old 55th Street Temple in New York, sure you remember actually, sometimes the kirtans would go on and on, sometimes we didn't even have class. I used to wonder if the kirtan leader would look at the class schedule and decide what they wanted to. But sometimes the kirtans would go on. I remember that. Sometimes they'd go on until breakfast. And sometimes we take the kirtans and go all over the temple, they put it in the kitchen and stuff. They get on the pots and go up to the roof. And yeah, well, that's, you know, what happened was Tamakrishna Maharaj noticed that we were spontaneously doing that. So he decided, okay, let's actually do it. So then every Monday, they'd go around with little Ramakrishna on the calendar. And as they started doing that, then we started waiting at our rooms to greet the deities.
And we had big, elaborate greetings.
Yeah, well, then we graduated.
And they came off and did a play.
Yeah, well,
take them all the rooms and all the different ashrams and each room, how clean it is, and offering incense.
That was a very nice way to have a maha cleanup in the temple. Yeah, pretty soon we had a competition between the floors, and then they would announce the next day, you know, the brahmacharya floor number 6 won the competition. But it all kind of happened naturally, spontaneously. We used to have this long let this fill out of the temple, and they were really fun. Of course, also with that temple, if you just went out the door, you were right in the center of one of the biggest cities in the world, too. So just all you had to do was walk out the door to do harm. Whatever kirtans go along, there is your mind. Yes, please.
No, I was just going to say we need to do that here.
Yeah, sure.
I remember once watching the kirtans and thinking, if you really want to preach here, don't wear two different color socks. Because we're so in the center of the city, you know, you dress like a schlep, and you wear shoes like schlep, you can't. And then everybody, you know, everybody would see.
Everybody would see, yeah, you're right. You're right smack dab. So any questions, comments, or discussions on this person put forward? What kind of taste do Brussels sprouts have? Well, you know, with Brussels sprouts, you're really not supposed to pick them until after it frosts. Has it frosted right here?
Yeah.
Wow. But somehow when it frosts, as soon as it frosts, the plant just gets all an anxiety that the winter's coming. And so it starts storing things for the winter, and so the taste of the Brussels sprouts. Yeah, wow. By the way, Brussels sprouts are really nice cooked with nutmeg and some molasses. But I'm not sure what natural taste they have. Yes. How do you desire Krishna praying if you don't know what it is? Well, there's some very nice verses in the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita where Krishna goes through one of several different ways of explaining the process of advancing in bhakti. And he says, just love me. And he says, if you can't do that, then you should do what?
Sure.
Sanya bhakti. He calls it abhyas yoga. Anybody know what abhyas means?
No.
Good guess. means practice. Abhyas yoga means practice yoga. And he says by doing abhyas yoga, you will develop ichha. You will develop a desire to attain me. So to get the desire for Krishna prema, this ichha, one does abhyas yoga. Now let's look at this abhyas yoga. What does yoga mean? Yoga means linking, means union. You know, union of love. Yoga also means a union of love. How do you practice love? How do you do that?
Serving.
But I mean, how do you add mood? You say, okay, everybody, for the next 15 minutes, we're all going to practice loving. Let's go. Okay. All right, time's up. I mean, it's, in a way, it's kind of ridiculous. How do you practice love? But no, by serving. What you do is, you see, what do people who love Krishna, what do they do? And you copy that under the direction of the Guru, according to the Shastra. People who love Krishna, they talk about him. You know, like if you love somebody, you talk about them, right? Isn't it? Oh, my child did this, my child did that. My husband did this, my husband. Not sure. If you love somebody, you hear about them. If you love somebody, you remember them. You think about what are they doing? Just like I always know what time zone my children are in. And I think about what they're doing, because I have some affection for them. So you remember them. Then you do something practical for them. Do some service for them. Not, I love you, 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 I love you. Okay, that's very good. I just broke my leg. Can you take me to the hospital? No, I'm busy eating chocolates. You know, so if you love somebody, you do some practical service for them. You serve those the people who are dear to them. You take care of the things that are dear to them. Right? You have a mood of affection and friendship for them. If you really love them, you give them everything. So we copy that. We practice that. And at first we're practicing it without much feeling. Devotional service. At first it's just service. Prabhupada says service without devotion is just business. But that's kind of what you start with. You start with service without much feeling. And gradually, 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 as you hear about Krishna and chant about Krishna, gradually you develop the design. Yes?
I think when we start our service, it's because we have sentiment. We just have a sentiment of Krishna, a sentiment of the devotees, a sentiment of Prabhupada, a sentiment that this is the right thing, this feels right. So based on that sentiment, that shraddha, we move forward. So there is some
sentiment. It's just not mature. And I really like one lecture Prabhupada gives on Bhagavad Gita 7.1. He says, we all already have a shakti. We all already have attachment. We just don't have it for Krishna directly. Everyone has attachment. Everyone. So you can think of what person or thing or whatever in my life do I have attachment to? Is there some, if there's something, and maybe just my own body, I may have attachment for my own intelligence or my own body or my own beauty or, you know, whatever. I mean, or maybe for a dog, or maybe for a house, or maybe for a car parts. Everybody has a question. So let's take that as a given. We all already have this kind of intense attachment. What do we tend to think about? Well, what do our thoughts sort of naturally flow to? What do our emotions naturally go to? Some other living being or something or something. And ultimately that is Krishna. Prabhupada also says this in the story of the wives of the Brahmanas bringing food to Krishna, that ultimately we all love Krishna because whatever we love is really Krishna, it's Krishna's energy. So we already know how to love. But that's not something we really need to be taught. We just have to change the object. And then once we love the object, and once we love Krishna, then naturally we'll love everybody else. It's not that if I love Krishna, then I'm mean to everybody else. That's not real love for Krishna. That's a very, very motivating way of practicing bhakti yoga. Great to work with. I love Krishna and I'll kill the Christians or the Muslims who don't love Krishna or I do. And the devotees. I'll yell at the devotee who puts their tail on the different.
beginning that the somebody said that there's a flower is a sign that God is good because you don't really need it. But I was thinking it's like I mean, modern society is famous with things we don't really need. It's not really a sign of love.
But modern society is filling us with things that we don't need. Those things are often harmful for us. They're not pleasant things, you know. And they're doing it so that we can exploit us.
We do think that God got in that regard. One is that you said you don't need, they're not necessities, but there's a higher necessity, a necessity for variety. Like Prabhupada says, variety is the mother of enjoyment. And there's a necessity for enjoyment. There's a necessity for variety. And so there are many varieties of life that Krishna gives us naturally. Our necessities in some sense. I mean, you may say honey isn't a necessity. You can live without honey, or you can live without marigolds. But on the other hand, if there were no flowers, people would feel, you know what I mean? We have a need for beautiful sunsets. We have a need for fragrances in general. We have a need for beautiful sights. And so Krishna creates, he's an artist, and he creates so many different
There's different sights. Those are needs of the soul, actually. But why is Krishna meeting those needs of the soul when we're rebellious? Is my point. Why is he doing that? Yeah, he doesn't have to do it. Doesn't have to do it.
On the other hand, sometimes I was thinking also that the one might say, okay, well, you say God is good because he's giving us things that we don't really need, you know, and just for our pleasure, so to speak. But on the other hand, they bind us. Because we become attached to that. We become attached to the beauty, the flowers, or whatever, some concession, whatever. And they root us here. We can't give them up. We become attached.
So this is the beginning of another class. But we will see if we can in 2 minutes. So this is the materialistic person takes all of these things that Krishna has given us, all the enjoyments of the world, and tries to steal them. The advanced spiritualist, like Prabhupada, Sri Kirti, who talks about how Prabhupada was given a jasmine flower and smelled it and said, "This is Krishna," and kept it on his pillow all night. So the great devotees, this is a little secret, folks, okay? This is going to sound really revolutionary. Pure devotees can actually enjoy the world. They can actually enjoy the world without being bound. And therefore we find sometimes that great devotees are in a position even of great opulence. Why? Because their enjoyment of the world is a loving exchange with Krishna. They're not enjoying it separately from Krishna. They're relishing Krishna, and Krishna's relishing that they're relishing him. I only do that. I give you a present, and when I see that you are enjoying the present, I feel happy. So, you know, I worked for an hour and earned my 30 euros, and I took those 30 euros, I bought you something, and what are you enjoying? You're enjoying my energy, my hour of energy. And I spent another 2 hours shopping for the thing. So 3 hours of my energy, you're enjoying my energy. But if you're doing it in relationship with me, if your enjoyment of my energy deepens our friendship or whatever relationship we have, well, that was why I used that energy. So the great devotees, they can enjoy the taste of the eggplants offered to Krishna and the marigolds offered. They're offering everything to Krishna. They're relating everything to Krishna. Now, those in the middle, who are neither materialist bound by trying to enjoy separately from Krishna, nor great devotees who are able to connect everything with Krishna, often have to stay away from some of these external forms. Because as soon as we go to the external forms of these pleasures, we forget Krishna. That's our misfortune. You know, we get some money from Krishna and then we just think, oh, money, we forget Krishna. I get the marigold from Krishna and I forget the colors coming from Krishna, the rasa of seeing the color. In my eye, that's Krishna. The rasa of the smell, that's Krishna. You know, the rasa of the touch, that's Krishna. I forget that. And I forget Krishna has given me this So therefore, you know, as practicing Abhyas Yoga, I may restrict how many clothes do I have, how much money do I have. I don't overcollect. I just say, okay, I'm just going to take exactly what I need. Because we're in danger that if we touch these things, then we're going to forget Krishna instead of come closer to Him. But even as practicing Abhyas Yoga, even doing so much Tripasti, still Krishna's giving us some pleasures. Isn't He? Still Krishna's giving us some pleasures. Whatever pleasures Krishna gives us, we see that. I really like it, the end of Brahma Samhita, can't really verse something. Rebecca Santasaraswati says, if one sees whatever one gets as the favor of the Lord, then all of his material activities become spiritualized. And of course, Krishna tells us this in the fifth chapter, that everything becomes transcendental. So whatever Krishna is giving us, start seeing that as Krishna. Start seeing that as Krishna. And then eventually, by the way, the material energy doesn't become dangerous. Eventually, the material energy shows her other form. She's called Vaishnavi. And it's explained in the Shastra, but eventually the material energy actually helps the devotee to surrender to Krishna. What the devotee is afraid of is not the things of the world per se. What the devotee is afraid of is this mentality of suffering, joy, and exploitation. That's what the devotee is afraid of. And so generally also the beginner thinks that the way to become detached is to stay away from the things of the world. But we're saying, no, use the things of the world in Krishna's service. And yes, restrict what you take for yourself and you have to. Because otherwise the tendency is to go to the extreme. So that's very short, but that's, you know, how to gradually see everything in relationship to Krishna so one can move in the world without being bound. When the things of the world are no longer binding to change one's consciousness. So that's what we're working on, trying to change our consciousness. Otherwise, just staying away from the things of the world will not work. It will not work. You know, eventually, you go back to them. So in the beginning, we may keep our distance, but that's not really, in and of itself, the process. The process is changing how we view that world, how we see the world, and how we see even the nice things. So this we could have a huge discussion on this one for 40 minutes. At one point. A month or a year maybe, you know, at one point. And we could have thousands of different points of view on why Krishna has provided the chilies and the pineapples. And how we see that. And how we can come closer to Krishna just by meditating on chilies and pineapples. So thank you very much. All glories to Srila.